Welcome to Meat Lake Production Interviews. This podcast is the audio version of video interviews that can be found in our YouTube channel or at meatlake.com. The video version will include many visual references that cannot be addressed in audio format. The podcast will now commence. Hello, welcome to another Meat Lake Productions interview. I am Eric Meat Lake, and I have with me the rising star that is Noah A.K. Noah Auerbach Katz.
Perfect, nailing it. The rising star. My star has peaked. It's on the downturn, but I thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, let's hope not. Thank you so much for your time and joining me today. A little bit about me. I'm sort of a process nerd. I've got some questions I like to ask about the intersection between VFX and practical effects, and how actors insert themselves to the roles. And, Star Trek's really good at making a really seamless experience out of that these days. It's been really stunning, like, the past couple of seasons. And so one of the questions I was asking about, this is sort of geared towards, young people who have artistic endeavors, I think. When I was looking at your IMDb page, it showed that you were starting, TV work, for example, in about 2017. Before that, was most of your training, was it more stage work?
Sure. Well, I graduated from Juilliard in 2015, so that's when I sort of went pro, if you will. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff I had done had been in theater, some smaller commercials. That was, those were sort of my first real TV jobs. I'm still not very experienced, especially compared to a lot of my peers. Mm-hmm. That was sort of, you really want to try and do as many different things as you can. And, TV pays way better. So that's always a good option as well.
Right. Probably a few more people watching TV than watching.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
When you went in the transition between working on a stage and working on a television, how different is that? What new things do you have to learn between being on a stage and being in front of a camera?
Well, I'm definitely still learning. I consider myself very much in process in that, because it's really, really different. I think you can just imagine there's just a lot going on. First off, the audience is so different, right? The audience is right in your face on TV or film. They're right there. They're catching every little nuance of your face, things you didn't even mean to do. Whereas in theater, they're pretty far away and they're not going to pick up, the smallest things, depending on the space, of course. But then there's just a lot of technical stuff about, as somebody who grew up doing theater, you sort of come to understand the lingo and how your days are going to look and how to prep. But TV and film is really different in the sense that you might do the same really intense scene 5 or 6 times, and you want to make it either really similar so they can use it, or really different so they have a lot of options. The days are way longer. Rehearsal days are maybe 10 to 5-ish, and you're usually doing stuff the whole time generally. But on a TV set, you might be there at 3 a.m. and leave at 10 p.m. and actually, be recording, actually be on camera for an hour of that, or maybe more. But there's a lot of, getting prepped to do something and then waiting a very long time doing it. Maybe it's just a quick, 5-second scene, 10-second scene, and then there's a huge reset. So that's a big pause. So the momentum is very different, and that's taken me some getting used to as well. The flip side of that is that, in theater, you really have to be hyper driving your imagination. You have to imagine that the audience isn't there, or if they are there, if you are letting them in some way, you kind of have to manipulate them or use them, feed off their energy or something. And you also, you look at the wings and you can see people waiting for their entrance, or you're waiting for your entrance. And in TV, a lot of the time, I'm out of focus, come back. A lot of the time in TV, everything is built and it's there. And there might be a camera right in your face, but there's also a screen displaying the numbers, and there's a real explosion, and there's, you know, all sorts of, especially on Star Trek, you know, all sorts of real physical, tangible things that really can activate your imagination in a different way, which I've really loved.
Right. Was it when, for example, when you were doing stage work, did you ever have any like big obstacles? Like, did you ever have any like stage fright, for example, that you had to get over? Or were you like, were you the, are you the kind of person who's like talkative enough where it was easy enough to get out there? Or...
Well, that's a great question. You know, growing up, I didn't have a ton of stage fright. I think a lot of it is just, first off, it's sort of exposure therapy. You know, the more you're, especially for somebody who's like a novice, those first few steps, especially if you're not, if you haven't done it as a kid, you know, when you're a kid, a lot of the time, you know, if you're sort of in a good place when you're doing it, you don't even really, doesn't even really register. Mm-hmm. And so as you grow up, you sort of have like trained that muscle, you know, but stepping into it as an adult or as a young person is really challenging because you can feel really exposed and really vulnerable,
right?
Because it's such an uncomfortable position to be in, but it definitely is exposure therapy for that. You know, in any kind of sort of public speaking or performance, the more you do it, the more comfortable you get. Of course, everybody, you know, still has stage fright and butterflies, and that stuff kind of never goes away because you're always kind of putting yourself out there, putting something you've created out there. You don't know if people like it, you know, even as an actor, you know, these are the artistic choices you've made for this character, and you kind of have to stand behind them, and you don't know how they're going to be received, especially early on in a run of a play or the first time an episode comes out or something like that. But I never really dealt with stage fright. And then when I was doing a play off Broadway in New York, and on opening night, I went up on one of my lines, which I usually don't do. And I got some pretty bad like stage fright. I kind of got the yips, and it took a while to work through that and kind of get over it and sort of slow down and not put so much pressure on myself. So, you know, it can kind of catch up at you at any moment.
You say you got the ups. So what is
I got the yips. It's like a baseball term where, like, you know, a pitcher suddenly can't throw a strike anymore. Oh, okay. And he loses the ability, or they lose the ability to like do the thing which they have trained their whole life to do, which is like throw a baseball. It's called the yips. And so I sort of had that feeling of the yips, which was like, man, this thing I was so confident in 45 minutes ago, I feel like I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. So it was a really disorienting thing, but a good learning moment where it was like, you know, not to take these things for granted. And when, you know, presented with a challenge like that, to find a way to sort of fight your way back tooth and nail. And it definitely gives you some internal fortitude.
Yeah, I would assume so. Cause I mean, you're preparing for this anyway ahead of time. So the answer to get over that is obviously not just preparation. Somehow you've got to reorient yourself.
It's practice. But then, you know, once, sort of like anything, once you're actually doing the thing, it's totally different. You know, you can practice in the rehearsal room without an audience, but once you're out on stage or once the camera's rolling, it suddenly is very different. And it's just about, you know, practice and comfort level, really.
Right. So when I was doing like research to figure out angles to ask you some kind of questions that you haven't already been asked before, like
good luck.
I was looking at the Juilliard School, and like I found something that I had never heard of before, which is like it said that they teach what's called the Alexander technique. So I'm not gonna I won't put you on the spot here. Like I have a little blurb to read about it, and the Trekkies probably recognize the name because we know that this is named after Alexander Rozenko. Here of House Mog and House Martok, you know, I'm sure this is correct. Is it seen here in his hologram
that's
program really that he wrote with Barclay? No, okay.
Yes, you know, actually in class, you just sit in a mud bath with the teacher and just sort of hang.
That's another great pull from the same episode. Right. No, but okay, actually,
that's
this is
funny, man.
This is actually... this is actually the guy here. This guy's name is Frederick Matthias Alexander, he goes by, I'm just going to read a brief blurb and then you can kind of explain how it is like talk. So this is Frederick Matthias Alexander. He was an Australian actor, and his story began when, as a young man, like he was trying to do recitation and elocution, and he had trouble with his voice and his vocal cords. So he went to the doctor to try to figure it out, and they couldn't figure out anything. So what he did is pretty interesting. He studied himself using mirrors to observe what he was doing, and he like was taking notes to figure out what he was doing wrong. And then he was able to through his observations and reasoning, he finally figured out a better technique to be able to project his voice. It seems like that's the gist that I'm getting from it.
I'm not a historian on this stuff, and I'm certainly not an expert. There are certainly experts. I guarantee there's an expert out there who is just going to like scream at both of us, but whatever. You know, in terms of acting, I think the idea, and it's relevant to sort of what he was doing, is, you know, your body holds a lot of tension, a lot of physical tension. And when you're trying to perform any task, really, that unwanted tension can be a problem. So, you know, a lot of the time that tension is held in the neck or the shoulders. And when you're tense in your neck, then it's going to constrict your vocal cords and make it difficult to project or to talk or to sustain vocal work for a long period of time. And so basically, in terms of acting, the technique is about releasing tension in your body so that you can engage in the task you want to engage in fully, you know?
Right.
So as you know, especially in acting, if you're holding in tension, that usually means that you're not putting it into the scene you're playing.
I see.
So that's sort of the idea, and that's done through all sorts of gobbledygook that it's not really worth getting into, to be honest, but but that's the general idea of, you know, what the Alexander technique is, how it's relevant to acting. And it's used for a lot of like posture work, because a lot of the time, like outside of sort of physical therapy and muscle building, a lot of posture is about like tension holding. So, you know, if you hold tension in one part of your body, your posture is going to be all screwed up. And if you can release that, or release another part of your body so the tension releases, then maybe your posture will kind of reset to a more natural state. I don't know how much science is behind it, to be honest with you, but I do know that when you're an actor and you're holding tension in your body that you don't want to be there, it's going to be challenging to do the performance you do want to do.
That reminds me a little bit of like, I had a tiny bit of like vocal training during college, and I ended up taking like private lessons because I wanted to learn how to project my voice through singing, but I didn't want to learn like the Broadway plays. So I'm like, asked the teacher, I'm like, you know, can you just teach me on the side, like outside of class? I'll drop the class and I'll pay you directly. She's like, sure, I can do that. So, and you know, she the main thing that I like learned that she was teaching is that you try to project as much as you can, like through your nasal cavity. And that way it saves your vocal cords. And I wonder if that's something similar with what he was, you know, discovering, or as far as that goes.
I think it's all sort of related in terms of like breath work and resonance in your body, and, you know, tension on the vocal cords. You know, there's a lot of different ways into that kind of stuff. Alexander's like one of it. I think for singing, it's sort of a whole nother level of like release of tension, because if you're singing a lot and you have tension in your vocal cords, or you're really squeezing your vocal cords, you'll wind up damaging your voice, especially if you're doing it like night after night, like in a play. You know, if you have to like scream in a play or yell in a play and you have to do it 8 times a week, you have to find a way to do it sustainably so that you don't tear up your voice. You know, where if you're in a movie, you can kind of, you know, scream for a day, and if you don't not working the next day, then you have time to recuperate, you know.
Right. And especially because if you're in front of microphones that are hidden right over your head, then you can speak softer. You don't have to.
Yes.
You may not even have to learn how to project that much.
It's true. But even still, you know, on film, you do want to sort of feel, it's that feeling that your voice is just coming naturally out of you and it's not constricted. And that physical feeling usually translates into the feeling that it feels really real and it's happening in the moment.
I see.
So yeah, just a bunch of tools in the actor's tool bag.
So yeah, that's I tend to be like really like pro college and pro education, and so I was like I was really interested in learning about this, and I was wondering like I don't know if this is even quantifiable or not, but like how much do you think like your college experience performed your ability to be prepared to go into the you know, attempting to do television work and things like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's all hard to say. I did go to undergrad as well. I went to Juilliard for graduate school, and I got a lot out of my undergrad experience at UC Santa Cruz doing theater there. And yeah, you know, very different experiences there. I think, I don't know, you know, honestly, I have a ton of opinions about Juilliard and about stuff that's like, you know, a little boring and a little bit, you know, up my own butt, if I'm being honest. But I did get to meet my wife there, so that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, the ultimately, it's this really delicate balance between, like, you know, acting as an art form and acting as an industry, you know? And I think that all acting schools sort of have to ride this balance between preparing you as an artist and preparing you as someone who's trying to make this their primary source of income in a really challenging industry. Mm-hmm. And I think there's parts that I would say this for Juilliard, and I would say this for pretty much all acting schools out there. There's places that they succeed in the artistic endeavor and places where they fail in that endeavor, and places where they succeed in the industry endeavor and places where they don't succeed, and to different varying degrees, you know. And I also think everyone who comes out of Juilliard has really different experiences as well. So, you know, some people really feel like it gave them everything. Some people don't feel that way. Juilliard is also an undergrad and graduate program combined. So people coming in as 18-year-olds have such different experiences than people coming in with a, you know, having already been a professional actor, already done undergrad. So there's just this really wide range of experiences, wide range of what it's like to work there. Yeah, you know, I think it does some things amazing and some things not as amazing, but, you know, as I got to meet Mary, so it's all good, you know?
Yeah, that's worth the price of admission right there.
Exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, I've also, you know, when I was looking at other podcasts that you had participated in and, like, following you online, I noted with your work with Insulin,
Let's see the pin.
And
let's
see the pin. I made my own pin here. Hell yeah. Did not have my own shirt, so you know, it's not a 3D print, but it can do this.
Yes. Hell yeah. Looking good. Okay. Whatever's happening right now.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. Whatever we're going to add in post. So yeah, I saw that there was a fundraiser where you were able to do, I think you hit like a $5,000 mark, and that was really cool. Do you have anything upcoming
I did two fundraisers. I did sort of just a general fundraiser when I first was like sort of entering the Trek Twitter sphere, because I just was like, you know, let me do something with this. And then I did another fundraiser where I was selling 3D prints of that badge you have, which some fans fabricated and designed and made that whole logo just sort of.
It's really cool. It's very
wanting to participate. Yeah. Yeah. And I think in total, and then actually just recently, another fan, Rian, did a little like impromptu giveaway. I was wearing some Andorian antenna at Destination London, where I had some, and everybody was taking photos with me. And she was like, I had forgotten to bring mine because I told people I'd bring it for like the last photo of the day. So she had it and I used hers. And then she did a fundraiser, which was amazing. And we raised another $500 for that. So that just happened on World Diabetes Day. There's nothing active right now, but I have some project stuff, which I'll spam everybody with shortly. So I'm always ready for another fundraiser.
Yeah.
But nothing I can talk about now, but hopefully something relatively soon, maybe in January.
Looking forward to that. And we'll put links to some, like, let's see, what's your...
yeah, just put a link to T1 International. That's the company that I, or the nonprofit that I work with. I really like them. They don't take pharmaceutical money, and they're really good about empowering people and not sort of kind of... they have sort of a grassroots bottom-up approach as opposed to a more top-down charity approach.
I see. So following in the like the sort of vein of activism, I wanted to ask another question. Like, Star Trek's always been like very progressive. It's got a long history of that, and both like in stories and also actors doing activism. And I noticed recently that the animators of the Lower Decks, they all voted to join the IASTE, International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. I was really excited to see that. Like, I myself I've been in a union here, like where I live in Japan, for like 17 years now, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, is that something that's mostly for the people behind the camera, and then are actors usually in, like, I found something.
So called the IATSE union sort of covers all the people behind the camera, and there was sort of this big kind of thing recently where they got new contracts and they were going to strike. It was a really big deal because of the usual stuff why unions exist. Film actors in the States are represented by SAG-AFTRA, which is our union, which is why we are not really we're like supportive, of course, of our IATSE brethren, but aren't actually involved in those negotiations or contracts at all, because we have our own separate union, our own separate contracts. And there's the Canadian Actors Union as well, which Star Trek specifically Discovery encompasses a lot of, because there's a lot of Canadian actors since we shoot in Toronto. And then there's the American Stage Actors Union called Actors Equity as well. So I'm double unioned in stage and film. Yeah, cool. I'm happy to be so.
Yeah, that's really cool. I was wondering, like, I know a lot of union activism, you know, anywhere in the world, it's always a lot of it has to do with working hours, trying to keep people healthy, right? And then I was just wondering what kind of balance, like, you would have to consider when you're doing, like, for example, when you're doing the prosthetics work that you know, you're involved in, like what you described is very long hours. Like, it's hard to, you can't, like, it's very difficult to do several hours of makeup and then acting and then break down and get back and have a normal hour of sleep. Like, how exactly is that balanced?
Well, it depends. I mean, in terms of contract and like the actual contract, it depends on company to company and production to production. There are rules, but it still allows for extremely, extremely long days, and you can have short turnarounds if the company pays more or finds loopholes and stuff like that. CBS, because it's a big network, is relatively good about working days, especially with COVID. They shorten those working days. A lot of the ones that people have bigger issue with are like the streaming platforms, because they're on a different kind of contract than even CBS. Even though it's on a streaming platform, it's not considered new media like Netflix or Apple or Amazon. But even still, it's they're crazy long days. They're super challenging days. They're a lot. You know, they are a lot. There's sort of no way around it. You know, for me, I knew I was sort of on a time limit, you know, so it made it really bearable, the long days. First off, you know, I was so happy to be there. It really just felt like a vacation in terms of like the work, you know. It was extremely challenging and daunting, but I never had that feeling of like, oh my God, you know, how am I going to get through this? Because the days were so fun and I knew that it was going to end, you know. But for, you know, someone like Doug Jones, I really don't know how he survives that because it's crazy. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy. You know, his makeup process is not super long, but it, that being in that makeup all day is just being inside of that makeup is like, it's sort of like somebody is just grabbing your face all day long. You know, it's just like a endless physical stimulation. Then you, you know, in your entire face, you know, inside your mouth. He doesn't have a nose, so his nose is running down into his mouth. He can't hear because he doesn't really have ears, and his ears are pushed against his head. He's got these contacts in which when you see him in person, you can literally see how they're pyramided off of his eyes. You can see how far away off their eyes are. You know, he's wearing gloves, so he can't like look at his phone. He can't do anything. He just sort of has to sit there. And then he has those boots on top of everything. So I don't know how he does that. And I think, you know, that's part of the reason why you don't see too many crew members in prosthetics. You know, yeah. It's expensive. It's challenging. It's adds so much work for everyone, you know, because it's not just Doug who has to get there at 3 a.m. It's everyone on set, you know, it's everyone, not just the prosthetics people, but the PAs, the food people, you know, so having that be a standard is just like really, really challenging to have, you know, a couple of people like that. It's just so much. And in between each take, you know, people have to come and check on him and make sure everything looks good and retouch it up. So it's just requires constant maintenance because he obviously can't do that himself. So it's just really, really challenging stuff.
Yeah, I was looking... on my recent, I did a watch through getting prepared for season 4, and I had forgotten, but like in the second season, like there's even a number of scenes where he's got his shirt off. So not only did he have the gloves and the hat, but he also had this full body suit.
I've never talked to Doug about that specific full body suit, but I have talked to him about like Shape of Water, and you know, he's just like, can't go to the bathroom. You know, it's always funny because I'm like, oh, I can do prosthetics forever. And then I'm like, but I don't know if I could actually do a full body suit, you know, for an extended period of time.
Right.
That would be really, really tough. I think I would pee my suit. It kind of
reminds me of I was reading a while ago that Jeffrey Dean Morgan, he played in Enterprise, and I didn't know it at the time because he had on a full face thing, and he said the experience was horrible for him, and like he wanted to quit acting. Like he said he went home crying because it just wasn't
one of
his
these
things
that you either can do or you can't. There's really no in between. My makeup person did the makeup application for Jim Carrey when he was doing The Grinch, and there's sort of this famous story about Jim Carrey tearing the mask off and then having to go to an FBI interrogator to learn torture techniques. Like how to sustain torture. And when you hear that story and you hear Jim Carrey, you sort of roll your eyes a little bit. You're like, all right, you know, whatever. But when you are in that mask, you understand because you have to maintain you have to maintain like this sort of sense of calm. You can't panic, you know, because you're trapped. If you have any sort of claustrophobia, that would absolutely activate because you are trapped inside of there. And it's not, you know, that's glued to my face. That is glued to my skin. It's not something you could take on and off. Like it takes an hour to get off. Mm-hmm. So once you're in, you're in.
One question that I had, like as someone that I've dealt with asthma and nasal issues my whole life, I'm pretty sure that would cut me out of it, but
you're screwed.
Well,
especially during the application, if you can see in the picture behind you, you can see how like you see how my neck just blue in the middle picture,
right?
That's already making me, it's just blue. But then if you look to the third picture, you can see suddenly it has all this white texture and it looks like built in. That is painted on with spray paint, so they're basically spray painting that whole mask. And so they're just shooting spray paint into your mouth and into your eyes and up your nose. And so that happens every morning. Yeah, and so that's repainted every single time. Once you're done, they cut it off, they throw it in the trash, and they start from the beginning.
My main question when I saw these pictures was, what does this smell and taste like? Because that sucks, man.
It sucks. Actually, that's one of the worst sensations of getting the mask on is the smell, because the spray paint has this sort of like, it just smells a little like a rotten, like bad breath smell. You know, it sort of smells like somebody is like has bad breath and is shooting it into your face. I got a tip from Doug, which is he has this little portable fan that he like blows on his, not like on his face, but like past his face. So that sort of shoots the smell away, which really helped a lot.
But on days when,
exactly. On days when I didn't have the fan or if the batteries went out, it was really hard because that smell will push you there, man. It'll get you there.
Sounds like a new union demand, flavored paint, flavored strawberry. Yeah. You should be tasting blueberry.
The taste wasn't so bad, honestly. The taste wasn't the thing. It was really the smell.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, in a flat, we want to put some kind of blue lilac smells for the Andorian paint.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Then on for your mannerisms, like, obviously, like Doug is very, he's developed like this way of walking, like he's the flowing hands behind him, and he's obviously practiced this a lot. Did you talk about specific mannerisms or postures for Ren?
Well, it's such a good question. You know, first off, like Doug is an incredible physical actor, and I'm just not. Like, I'm a fine physical actor, but Doug is an incredible physical actor. And, you know, one of the things I did when I first got the part was reach out to Ken Mitchell, Mary Chifo, and Doug and be like, you know, what do you do? How do you do this? And they talk so much about using their body and stuff, which I think is really good advice. But the real thing about Rin was that, like, he's not Saru, you know? He's not, like, this tall, lanky. He doesn't have exaggerated body features, you know? He doesn't have these hooves. And he's also not a Klingon, which is such, like, a physical-bodied species, you know? You can't be a Klingon without being completely in your body. You know, it's just big and physical. And then on top of that, you know, what's great about Doug is he's like created this whole sort of Kelpian movement system. But my movement is Jeffrey Combs, you know, who's just walking around like a guy. Yeah. You know, there's nothing specific, other than the antenna moving. There's no real movement there that I could sort of bring to the table. And then you sort of run the risk of sort of, you know, all right, well, let me do some big movement so the mask come through. And then it's like, well, what are we doing here? And especially when you... And then on top of that, you know, the character is, especially when you first meet him, is very internal. He's very closed down. He's like, he's sort of broken in this way.
Right. This is the first shot. You know? The first shot is like, you're really in a beaten down, as beaten down as you can. You're essentially a slave, right?
Exactly. And he's just like totally broken. And so it wouldn't make a ton of sense for him to, you know, have a big physical gesture.
Right.
At least didn't for me at the time.
Right.
And then also when you're paired with David, with Book, he's such a physical actor. He's so in his body. Book is such a suave, movement-based character.
He's very fluid. That,
you know, he's very fluid. He's got a great swagger. That it didn't feel, it also felt like, well, let me see if I can juxtapose this a little bit. Let me give Book, let me like highlight how confident and in his body Book is in this horrible setting by really showing somebody who isn't, you know, who's literally had pieces of his body taken away from him.
Right. There's one image here where like you're both sitting here talking to each other, and like even this, like, you know, I think he's actually smiling in this because he's getting the attack is about to happen.
And even, you know, even in this scene, he makes the big physical gesture, which is like reaching across and grabbing my shoulder. You know, he's the one sort of leading that.
Right.
And you know, we're trying to be secret. We're in a Star Trek prison. You know, we got to do the Star Trek whisper.
Right.
you know, early on, I was worried because those were sort of the tricks, you know, and I would also notice, you know, the mask doesn't respond to your face. It's not a one-to-one. It's a thick right. piece of rubber on your face. So in order to manipulate it, you really have to make like a big face if you're trying to really get a gesture to go through the mask. And there's, you know, it didn't really, it, you sort of put yourself in the position where you're going to make a face underneath, which doesn't line up with the experience. So your voice or your action is going to ring false, or you're going to make a big face. And it's going to, what I found a lot of the time is it would reveal the mask. It would make, it would crinkle the mask. It would make it look plasticky and fake.
I guess you had to practice that quite a bit before.
Well, what I really landed on was, you know, I was like, first I was like, what the hell am I going to do? This is really bad. But then, you know, I was working with David, and David has these amazing large eyes, which especially pop on camera. And I sort of was like, well, you know, what if I don't do a lot of this extra work? What if I sort of let the camera do a lot of work? What if I actually let the mask do a lot of work? And, you know, the only thing in that picture that is my physical body is the whites of my eyes. My lips are covered, my eyes are covered, but I figured, you know, here's something that is me. And if I can sort of try and tell a story through my eyes, I'm in these close-ups, you know, I'm not in a full body shot like a Klingon. I'm not doing a walk and talk from afar like Doug. So there's right. not a lot of physical, and a lot of the stuff I did was pretty static. So I thought, you know, let me actually let this really, really detailed and dynamic mask tell the story of the physicality of this guy. And I'll sort of tell the emotional story with my eyes. And I felt like that worked pretty well. His face is so detailed that,
this I thought was a really beautiful shot as well. Like you can, cause you've got your eyes in this particular shot, you know, I think this is just a passing shot when the narration at the beginning, but even then you can see, you can read a lot into the eyes in this particular
scene. Yeah, thank shot. You. Yeah, I appreciate that. And then you just look at the rest of that face, and the face just looks like it is just telling a story. So I didn't feel it was like, well, I don't need to manipulate this face. The face is already manipulated. Look at it. It's crazy. You know what I mean? Like you can project a full-on story to this. I don't need to kind of add anything to
it. There's a lot of history already that's been sculpted into this.
Exactly.
So you talked a lot about like the environment, like the like explosions going off. Like there is a sequence as you're escaping here. Let me get out of the way. I look like I'm escaping with you.
Look at my googly eyes. You can see when my contacts have kind of slipped because it looks like my eyes are sort of uncrossing a little bit.
I see that. And then like right after this, like in the next frame, you've got like, this is a real explosion. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in this thing, you know, this is my second day of shooting. We're in Hamilton, Canada, which is sort of like a working class industry town. I don't know. Somebody from Canada is going to yell at me, but whatever. And we're at this steel factory called Stelco, and there's 40 extras. And I mean, look at David's eyes. They're just so, I was just trying to copy him the whole time. Yeah. That's all I tried to do. But basically they had these huge pits set up with these giant fireballs, which they call dragon farts. And the guys were like, you know, the pyro guys were like, look, like, yeah, it's, you know, here's your action. You need to run up this hill, run down this hill, get all the extras over, run past this. There's another fireball over there, and there's all this scattered debris. Yeah.
Yeah. And, here's where you're directing traffic here, right?
Exactly. And these are all just like extras that I'm really telling, like the whole time I was telling, like, don't trip, you know, because that's all gravel and there's all stuff over here. I'm like, I just really don't want to see, you know, one of these people just go face first into a rock.
Into the pit.
On my first day of shooting. Exactly. Yeah. And the pyro guys were like, look, you can't get too near to this fireball. It's going to melt the plastic onto your face. So, you know, acting's done. You know, the fireball's there. It's real. Like, I'm really serious about not getting blown up in that scene because, you know, it's going to really, it's real up if I do.
Right. And then I wanted to also ask the, for example, like you, in this scene, this is where you got shot, obviously. Like, in this scene, was this, like, what's coming out of your body, was that all CG, or did you have any kind of...
This is all CGI. So basically what actually happened was on the second day of shooting, we were going to shoot this scene. Right before. So what happened was I had a stunt double. The stunt double was supposed to run and do like a full on like dive, like, you know, leap, like FBI taking the bullet leap. Oh, on the first take, he jumped. He, because it's gravel and it was kind of wet, he tore his ACL just right there. Wow. First take. And then this massive thunderstorm came in like 30 seconds later. All the power went out. My trailer was like rocking me back and forth, and they called it. So we moved it to the actual set at Pinewoods. They built basically a giant mock set and had the gravel everywhere. And then basically this little shot replaced this dive. And it was essentially me stepping into frame and then going, ah.
Okay. So that was,
they were like, that was it. I just, and I did that like 40 times and they were like, all right, we got it. And so all the rest is CGI there.
Yeah. I was wondering if there was like any exploding packets of liquid or anything to help you with the timing. Okay.
40 times they got it.
Yeah. I think you're one of the few people who's been shot close up more than once in the Star Trek universe, right?
I know. Well, I was like, I'm coming back for a second. If I didn't die there, I'm coming back for a second episode. That's for sure.
Right. And then in the second episode, I think I heard you talk about how you had a scene where Jonathan Frakes, when he was directing your next two episodes, where he told you to, you know, kind of pull it back in a little bit. Was that this episode? Because I remember you discussing that.
Me and Mary both came in super hot, and he pulled us both aside separately and was like, you guys need to cool it. This is not a lover's spat. It's not the scene. We're trying to talk about book here. Right. And he was right, looking back on the scene. But it was great. It was so much fun.
The scene came out beautiful, and I thought you guys still managed to look like you were, you know, you were adversarial here. Like, you gave each other some stares, so that it was allowed. I almost want to
still there.
I almost want to see the outtakes.
I
came in
like so hot, man. I was like, yeah, I was that goddamn captain. Like, you need to relax, dude.
And like,
it was great.
Also during my rewatch, I found this, like this right here. You got the thumbs up here.
My thumbs up. Now I will.
This
say
needs to be a meme, right? A Rin approves.
It is a meme. This is a meme. This is a GIF. And this was my idea. I said, can I do a thumbs up? Because I knew it was a great GIF. And they said, hell yeah. And so that is, I made that happen.
That's a contribution to Star Trek shitposting, basically.
Exactly. That's my contribution to shitposting. You're welcome, everybody.
That is amazing.
It gets used on Twitter all the time as a GIF, and it makes me very happy every single time.
That is really good. And I have a brief confession to make. When I was watching this... I guess I had some things going on myself last year, and I must have missed some ready rooms, but I had no idea that you were married to Mary. When I was watching this, up until the point where I was doing my research, and I was like, holy shit, are you serious?
Yeah.
I'm probably the last person in the Star Trek universe to know this, but it was like, it was such a nice thing to find out. It just seems like there's such a deluge of horrible things you can read on the news every day, and this is a nice gem to find out. I was very happy.
I agree.
So
I agree.
All the best.
I was very happy too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, on your final part or your final appearance, have you actually seen like what the like almost like frame by frame, like what they did with the technology on these new guns? It's an interesting transition. The death scene was like actually very traumatic, I think, for me. Like, even watching it, I was like, okay, I'm not really prepared for this, because partly it reminded me in some ways of like the death of Tasha Yar, in the sense that it was just like nonchalant, like, you know,
the skin of
evil is just like, get away, and then it's just gone, like in an instant, with this like an effortless flick. And then it also reminded me of, you know, Star Trek fans, this is not The Walking Dead. We're not used to seeing our heroes, you know, get die on screen very often.
Yeah.
And especially like this one, you think, oh, okay, books talked her out of it. And then she just turns around and it's like, it's almost a Game of Thrones kind of moment. Like you think, okay, it's not going to happen, but then it does. And that makes it all the more shocking.
You know, like, I thought a lot about it. You know, obviously everybody wants to live forever, right. But I was never going to, you know, I never came on set thinking like, oh, this is it. You know, I knew Star Trek well enough to know that one way or another, like, you know, I think in Next Gen, you do have quite a few deaths. You just have them a third of the episode in, you know, the guest star dies either at the very end or at sort of the very beginning to kick off the plot. So you don't really have like these mini arcs ending in a death, but there are quite a few people, you know, dying, you know, right. And I think it's a part of it. And, you know, as I revisited it with like a bit more distance, I really came to actually appreciate it because he gets a moment. It's not a big, it's not a speech about the Federation. You know what I mean? It's not like a speech about Star Trek, capital ST Star Trek. It's a speech about like his personal growth, his journey, what he's willing to like live and die for, how he's no longer willing to sacrifice his integrity anymore or ever again. And right. I think that, and then he understands what he's doing. And I think that rang true with a lot of people and it rang true with me. And it rings true in a real Star Trek way, you know, outside of just sort of Federation values, which are great. And then I also like, you know, there's something great about, there's so much backstory of his that we don't get to. And one thing I really do like is that there's a lot of like mystery left. And I feel like one thing you don't find on Star Trek is characters or things with mystery, with things that are unexplained. So much of Star Trek is about explaining, is about learning, and is about getting to know it so, so well, you know, both like from a writer's standpoint and from a fan standpoint. So having somebody who has this challenging, intricate, you know, possibly contradictory history, and not getting to explore it, I actually find very gratifying as a Star Trek fan to have there be a sense of longing for more. And I find it really realistic, you know, I find it realistic in the sense that, you know, you don't get to know everything all the time and you don't get to always save the thing. But, you know, if you sort of stand true to who you are and what you believe in, you go out on top no matter what.
Yeah. I really appreciated his defiance at the end. He's like, nope, not helping you. And then accept the consequences and just like,
whatever. He knows it's coming, you know? He knows Osira better than anybody there.
Right. And yeah, part when you were talking about the mystery, that reminded me, like, when I was doing, like prep for the interview, I was, like, you know, obviously researching, like, the Andorian before you, which is Shran. And, like, I didn't realize, but, you know, he's got, like, a second name. It's Thylek Shran, I think, is right. How it's pronounced. Right. And, like, was there any discussion about Ren having like a family name or a second name?
No, you know, there wasn't really anything. I'm sure part of my thing on set was I really actually didn't want to sort of get into conversations with people about anything other than what was on the script because I didn't want to get myself disappointed, you know. Right. I didn't want to hear his backstory that somebody's written and then for him to die like that, you know, in a way that actually would have been not really very fun as an actor. And it would have been more painful as opposed to having ownership of, in my own imagination of it. So I'm sure I could have sort of pressed more for what they thought or who he was, or, you know, they've all done their work. And so I sort of did mine and it just wasn't really relevant to what I was trying to do to know their exact story. But there's definitely, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of mystery there in terms of like, he led an uprising in this mafioso, you know, cartel. It's a crazy thing. And like, what was that? Was it a big one? Was it just him standing up at the last minute? You know, there was something that was edited out at one point, which was that I was the accountant for the Emerald Chain. They cut that. Oh. And that's why I knew about the dilithium. And just like something like that is just so fascinating. And I love not knowing more than that. It just sort of is fun. You know, it's just like, oh, there's this whole world back there that I get to kind of have and say whatever I want and nobody can contradict me. Whatever I say about his past is canon. So in your face, you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's fun that way. Right.
Because it should just be fun at this point, you know?
If Ren was like a member of, was in a D&D universe, what do you think his, what would his alignment be?
I think he'd be lawful good. He's a lawful very good aligned character. Yeah, he's not. I think early on people were like, oh, watch out for him, and I was like, no. He's not stabbing anybody in the back. He's straight up a good character.
So, given what we know about the difference between our characters and people in the mirror universe, what kind of dastardly person do you think Rin would be? I mean, in season one we saw that Andorians were good guys.
They were good guys because Georgiou is queen of Andor.
Right.
Maybe he would have turned. Maybe he would be, you know, one of these sort of informants on Andoria to keep the populace in line.
Right. And especially 1,000 years later.
The regions of Andoria.
Exactly. Exactly. You've said that you would basically play any role that you're offered in the future in Star Trek, like
and honestly in anything.
Yeah. whoever's listening, yeah, exactly. So, but if you could write a character for out of focus, if you could write a character for like any current series of Star Trek, whether you play in it or not, like what would you have an interest in like inserting if you were invited to the writer's table? What would you be interested in exploring as a writer?
I think as a writer, that's an interesting question. It's really challenging, you know. I really appreciate all writers of Trek, all the disco writers, because it's a really daunting task, you know. You have to balance so much canon, beta canon, the canon that we don't know about, that's sort of like, you know, basically like new Trek canon that all has to coagulate in some way. Fan canon, you know, you have to incorporate that. Meme canon, it's really intense. You know, if I were going to write a character, I feel like, you know, I'm always interested when there's sort of a more Machiavellian type coming in and participating with the Federation, sort of like a Garrick or Gul Dukat. So that's, I think that would be a fun, interesting thing to explore, how someone as righteous as the Discovery crew sort of deals with somebody who isn't good or bad.
Is like chaotic neutral almost.
Yeah, a little bit more, you know, chaotic neutral with a heart of gold, you know. I don't think there's really been quite that. You know, I think Book is ultimately good. He's a good guy. He's just is like a badass, you know.
Right.
And Lorca was just bad, you know. I think maybe the closest thing is actually Georgiou.
Mm-hmm.
By being honest, it is Georgiou, but I think she's like so above everything, you know, in a good way. You know, she's like the queen of the universe, so somebody who's a little bit more in the trenches in that way might be fun. I don't know.
That sounds good. So I guess this is my last question. Like I was just puzzled, like on the actual scene, on your final scene where, you know, first you're standing there, then you're not, and like on that particular scene, like on the physical nature of shooting the scene, This is the aftermath. Like, did they have you like jump out of the way?
Or? Yeah, no, basically, I would just say my line. I'd walk, I'd step behind the camera, and then she'd go like this, and David would cry out in pain. Just kind of walk away. There's kind of no rush.
Oh, I see. So like when he started the shock. Like, you were already gone. Off of camera.
I was already gone. There's nobody there.
I see.
Unless it was like a cut and they did a close up on him, which I was probably still there for.
I'll show you. I was just interested in like the scene by scene.
I mean,
like,
if I'm being totally honest, How they did it, no idea. All I know is they would go, Noah, just come over here. But it had a really nice, in the moment, it had a really nice gravitas to it, yeah. You know, because we shot it in order. So
the transition is vicious and yeah. Rude. Like, this is the first inkling of there's like two frames. There's yeah, right here,
super fast,
and then man. There's another frame where it's right there, and then the next scene is just lit up like this. And this yeah. is interesting because, like, they see how, like, it extends down through your body in, like, this lighting yeah. arc. And, yeah. like, you know, I can go frame by frame on Star Trek Star Trek effects all day long. And I was just wondering if they, like, made you fall away and somebody catch you or
no, if it was, no, it was just, less. I just walked out and then they worked their magic. I truly have no idea what they did.
Okay. Well, I think that's basically all of my questions. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope to see you again in something else someday, for hopefully in Star Trek, or I've got some things from your IMDb page on my watch list now, so and I'll be looking forward to your fundraiser again.
Yes,
we can do this.
Amazing.
Yep. So thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. No one's asked me about the Alexander technique, so you did it. And enjoy Bread Factory Part 1.
Oh, Bread Factory Part 1. Yeah. Downloading that right after we get off.
Okay. Amazing, amazing. Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it. I'm always happy to look at pictures myself. So there you okay. go.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your time. Have a good day.
Absolutely.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you for watching. I hope this was entertaining and informative. I want to thank the rising star that is Noah Averback Katz for his time and kindness. Please check out his partnership with T1 International at t1international.com. I want to thank my brother Randall Lifford for the Star Trek-ish music in the intro and for his sound engineering skills throughout the episode. I would like to thank my partners at Meatleg Production for the post-production assistance. You can find more about our VFX capabilities and all of our work at meatleg.com, which includes our original collaborative series called The Quantum Twins. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and let us know if you would like to collaborate.